We would like to send out a special thanks to the fun and challenging Best Fiends, the infamously impossible-to-put-down puzzle game. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the show. September 4th, 1964. Great Falls, Montana. 43-year-old Jim Arata and his 35-year-old wife Lois Arata are found stabbed to death inside a grocery store, which Jim manages. Since the couple's children last saw them at their home when they went to bed the previous night, investigators theorize that Jim and Lois were lured to the store and killed in a botched robbery. Over 37 years later, a former store employee named Alan Reevely is charged with the murders, but he winds up being acquitted when he goes on trial, so the actual truth about who killed the Aradas is left up for debate. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring an older case involving the brutal deaths of a married couple, the 1964 murders of Jim and Lois Arata. This case was originally suggested to me about 2 years ago by a listener named Melanie, and while I had never heard of it before, it features a number of twists and turns. At the time these murders took place, Jim Arata was the manager of a Super Save grocery store in Great Falls, Montana, but when employees arrived to open up the store one morning, they discovered the bodies of Jim and his wife, Lois, who had both been bound, gagged, and stabbed multiple times. And what was particularly tragic is that the Aradas left behind 7 children. There were a number of potential suspects, but the most intriguing was an 18-year-old former employee named Alan Reevely, who had been fired from the store weeks earlier for theft. It would be 4 decades before Alan was charged with the murders, but the problem is that no physical evidence linked him to the crime, and the case was based largely on the interpretation of supposedly incriminating statements he made over the years. Instead of going to a jury, Alan's defense team asked for a bench trial, a strategy which paid off when the judge ruled that the evidence against Alan was not strong enough to convict him beyond a reasonable doubt and found him not guilty. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that Alan did not do it, but there are so many baffling, unanswered questions about this crime that it has been the subject of heavy debate in Great Falls for nearly 60 years, so we're going to provide our own in-depth analysis into the case on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved murders of Jim and Lois Arata. But before we continue, I would like to take a few moments to talk about our sponsor, Best Fiends. We all have forms of entertainment which we consider to be guilty pleasures, whether it be a campy TV show, a cheesy movie, a song that's secretly your jam. Hell, some people would consider the true crime genre to be a guilty pleasure. But you know what form of entertainment I feel zero guilt about? Best Fiends, which provides an endless source of fun which I can access anytime on my phone. It's a match-3 puzzle game unlike any other, with thousands of levels and new content being added all the time. So I guess you could say, I'm a little obsessed. Okay, scratch that. A lot obsessed. Researching and recording a true crime podcast can sometimes be grueling work, so Best Fiends functions as a good outlet to help me unwind. I never thought I would play a handheld puzzle game for this long, but it's been about a year and a half since I originally started Best Fiends, and I recently passed level 1200. Does this sound fun to you? Well, you can download Best Fiends free today from the Apple App Store and Google Play and get started. I'd love to know what you think, but just don't blame me if you've become slightly obsessed. This game is what I'd like to describe as boredom's worst nightmare. So download Best Fiends free today from the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. Our story begins in Great Falls, Montana in 1964. Our central figures are 43-year-old Jim Arata and his 35-year-old wife Lois Arata, who have been married for 12 years and have four sons and three daughters. 12-year-old Terry, 10-year-old John, 8-year-old Mike, 6-year-old Tony, 5-year-old Danny, 3-year-old Randy, and 10-month-old Margaret. Lois is Jim's third wife, as he also has two other children from his first marriage, which ended in 1950. He would soon get remarried, but tragically lost his second wife to an illness only 1 year later. Jim is a World War II veteran who served in the Marine Corps, but for the past 2 years, he has been the manager of the Eastside Super Save grocery store. At around 7:45 a.m. on the morning of Friday, September the 4th, the Super Save's assistant manager arrived at the store to open for business, and two of the first people to enter were a beer salesman named John Krupar and the produce manager, Clarence Anderson. When Krupar walked to the back of the store, he was shocked to discover Lois Arata's body on the floor near the produce section. A clothesline had been taken from a store display and used to bind Lois's arms, entire feet, to a rear door. She was also gagged with a string that was torn from a cloth apron the employees usually wore. Lois had been stabbed 13 times, and the murder weapon, a long-bladed trimming knife from the produce section, was lying next to her body in a pool of blood. It wasn't long before Clarence Anderson entered a storage room located about 25 feet away from Lois's body, and after flicking on the lights, he discovered Jim Arata on the floor. Jim's feet and his right arm were bound with clothesline, and he'd also been gagged with string from an apron before he was stabbed 9 times in the back. Shards of broken Pepsi bottles were found at the scene, which had been used to strike both Jim and Lois in the head. The only thing which appeared to have been stolen from the store was $32 in cash from the register at a courtesy counter, which is ordinarily used to collect fees for hunting and fishing licenses. The coroner would later determine that the Arratas were likely killed sometime after midnight, but the crime left everyone completely baffled, particularly since Jim and Lois had last been seen at their house the previous night. Around the same time the bodies were discovered, their 7 children woke up, and were surprised to see that their parents were not home. The family car, a 1959 Plymouth station wagon, was also gone, so the oldest daughter, Terry, had to take the reins and help get everyone ready for school. Later that day, they received the horrifying news about what happened to their parents. The children had gone to bed at 9 p.m. on the evening of September the 3rd, and said that their parents were still home at that time, and everything seemed normal. For the most part, they did not report seeing or hearing anything unusual during the night, though Terry recounted one strange experience. She remembered being momentarily awakened at around 1 a.m. and seeing the shadowy outline of a man briefly step into her bedroom before closing the door. Terry fell back asleep, and while she claimed she did not see this man's face, she said he appeared to be over 6 feet tall and had short blonde hair. Indeed, it was soon discovered that a valuable coin collection Jim owned, worth around $1,500, was now missing from his bedroom, lending credence to the idea that an intruder had been inside the residence. The Arata station wagon would be discovered in an alley located a block and a half away from their house, and a pair of blood-stained elkskin gloves, which had been stolen from the store, were found in a nearby dumpster. A witness would report having seen the station wagon running outside the Arata residence at around midnight with its lights on, and even though Jim and Lois were found wearing street clothes, their bed showed signs of having been slept in. This caused investigators to theorize that sometime after the children went to bed, someone contacted Jim and convinced him to drive to the Super Save store, and for reasons unknown, Jim took Lois with him. After they arrived, Jim and Lois were attacked, and since a trail of blood was found on the floor near the store's safe inside the office, the perpetrator may have been planning to force Jim to open it, which is why one of his arms was untied. The problem was that 2 weeks earlier, the safe had been fitted with a time lock which automatically kept it sealed overnight, meaning that Jim would not have been able to open it, no matter what. The killer may have reacted to this by stabbing the Arradas in a fit of rage before taking their car to drive back to their residence and steal the coin collection. This theory was supported by the fact that Terry found her father's set of house, car, and store keys on the kitchen counter that morning, which could have been left there by the killer. 12 days after the murders, 10 of the 12 coin books from Jim's missing collection were found in the Missouri River near the Black Eagle Dam, but they were all empty, and the coins themselves were never recovered. The crime proved so traumatic for the Arada children that they all moved away and went to live with their maternal grandparents in Oregon. Unfortunately, the police's investigation of the crime scene was very rushed, as the Super Save's owners exerted pressure to have the store reopened for business as quickly as possible. As a result, the Super Save opened up again at noon that day, only 4 hours after the bodies were originally discovered. The cleanup was done so hastily that smears of blood continued to be found throughout the store during the ensuing days, and Jim's blood-soaked wallet would be discovered in a pile of lettuce. The wallet was empty, but it was believed that he was only carrying $5 in cash on him at the time. During the course of the investigation, over 100 people would be questioned, but 3 of them stood out as potential suspects, and they each happened to be current or former employees of the Super Save. One of them was Clarence Anderson, the produce manager who discovered Jim's body, as he was known for being an alcoholic and having a violent temper, and he reportedly got into a heated argument with Jim in the weeks prior to the murders. In fact, when Anderson showed up at the store on the morning of September the 4th, he had some noticeable cuts on his hands, though he said he got them from work. The second person of interest was George Suhada, the Super Save's night janitor, who had been let into the store by the assistant manager after it closed for the night. Suhada told police that he had left earlier than usual, because he heard noises which gave him the quote-unquote heebie-jeebies, but he failed to provide a verifiable alibi which could account for his whereabouts after 12:50 a.m. However, the most intriguing person of interest was 18-year-old Alan Reevely, a recent high school graduate who had worked as a box boy at the Super Save for 2 years, but wound up being fired by Jim 19 days before the murder. According to the assistant manager, Alan had a habit of stealing money from the cash drawers and was believed to have pocketed over $1,100 before he was caught. The last time Alan was seen at the store before the murders was when he stopped by to pick up his paycheck, and the other employees noticed that he seemed to be keeping a close eye on the office and asking about the money being kept there. Alan likely would have known that the store usually had larger amounts of money inside the safe on Thursday and Friday nights, but he did not know about the safe's time lock, as Jim did not have it installed until after Alan was fired. Since the store's employees immediately provided the police with Alan Reevely's name, they went to his house to question him only hours after the bodies were discovered. At the time, Alan was living with his parents, Ray and Barbara Reevely, and his younger sister, Susan. When police arrived, Barbara answered the door and told police that Alan was at work with his father. That very same morning, Barbara had washed the clothes Alan wore the previous night, and they were hanging out to dry on a clothesline, so police took them into evidence. Barbara provided an alibi for her son, claiming that the whole family played Monopoly together until around 10:30 p.m. before they all went to bed. Barbara then woke up Alan for work at 6:15 a.m. the following morning. Alan slept in the basement, while his sister Susan slept in a room across the hall, and she would later say that if Alan had gone up the stairs and left the house at any point during the night, she would have heard him. Nevertheless, police kept their focus on Alan, who was going through some personal drama with his girlfriend, Mary Klesch. Alan often fought with his parents about his relationship with Mary, as she had a habit of calling the house as many as 20 times per day, and they did not approve of her. In fact, things got so heated that Ray and Barbara placed Alan in a psychiatric ward in order to calm everyone down, and he would be released only 1 week before the murders. Ray apparently demanded that Alan break up with Mary, but she told Alan that she believed she was pregnant. On the evening of September the 3rd, Ray caught Alan at Mary's house and discovered some baby clothes inside the trunk of his car, which led to another heated argument between them. Investigators began to theorize that Alan wanted to run off with Mary and desperately needed money, which is why he attempted to rob the Super Save and led to the Arradas being murdered. However, it turned out that Mary was not actually pregnant at all, and her relationship with Alan eventually came to an end. There was no evidence to implicate Alan or any of the other potential suspects, so the investigation reached a standstill. As the years went by, Clarence Anderson and George Suhada would pass away, but the case would be reopened by John Cameron and Jeer Carpenter, a pair of cold case investigators with the Great Falls Police Department. On September the 4th, 2001, the exact 37-year anniversary of the murders, the two detectives decided to bring in Alan Reevely for a new interview. By this point, Alan was 56 years old, and after moving away from Great Falls for several years, he eventually returned and was now married with 5 children. He had become executive director of the Great Falls Community Food Bank and was generally considered to be a very well-liked and respected pillar of the community. But detectives decided to take a fresh look at Alan, thanks largely to a story shared by Jeer Carpenter's brother, Steve Carpenter. Alan often held Roman Catholic religious retreats, but according to Steve Carpenter, in October of 1994, Alan spoke to a group of people at one of these retreats about the Arada murders and how it brought him closer to God. He apparently shared an emotional account of how he walked into the store and personally discovered the Arada's bodies, but of course this story was not true at all, as Alan was no longer employed by the store at that time. Another witness from the retreat also claimed that he once saw Alan break down crying and make comments about how he had, quote-unquote, been forced to kill some people as a young man and needed redemption. At the time, the witness thought Alan may have been referring to an experience in Vietnam, but Alan never served in the military, and these statements took on a greater significance once it turned out he had been a potential suspect in a double homicide. When re-interviewed by Detectives Cameron and Carpenter, Alan admitted that he had once dealt with the fear that he could have murdered the Arradas without remembering it, stating, quote, "I asked my parents if I could have done this. They said no. I asked my psychiatrist. He said no." End quote. Alan also brought up the possibility of getting a therapist or a hypnotist to unblock his memories, stating, quote, "In my heart, I know that I didn't do that. If it's there, if I'm guilty, then it's got to come out for everybody's sake. I've got to find somebody to unlock that." End quote. When Detective Cameron asked Alan how he felt about the possibility of the crime being solved, he replied, quote, "That's fine. I mean, I don't have a problem with that. I'd like to see it solved too. I'm not looking forward to going to jail because I did this, but I know I didn't, but I would like to see this solved." End quote. Well, the day after the interview, Alan met up at a local motel with his former girlfriend, Mary Klesch, who is now going by the name Mary Jane Fors. However, Alan was unaware that the police had wired Mary with a secret microphone inside her purse to record their conversation. They wanted Mary to bring up the Arada murders and hoped that Alan might be recorded making a confession to the crime. At one point, Mary said that the police told her that they knew she was Alan's accomplice in the murders, but she assured him that if he admitted the crime to her, she wouldn't tell anyone. Alan responded by stating, quote, "I don't think they have any evidence, any proof, and I didn't do it." End quote. Well, on March the 15th, 2002, Alan was finally arrested and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder. The arrest took place when police burst into an art auction where Alan was working as a spotter, and in an astounding coincidence, Jim Arada's younger brother, Bob Arada, who lived nearly 200 miles away in the town of Bozeman, had decided to travel to Great Falls to attend this art auction. Bob was there only a few hours before Alan's arrest took place, completely unaware he had been sharing the same room with his brother's alleged killer. But since this was a high-profile social event, and Alan was still a revered figure in the community, there was a lot of backlash against how the arrest was handled. However, the public's perception of Alan would change a few weeks later, when he was charged with 96 additional counts of theft, 19 of which were felonies, and 77 of which were misdemeanors. As you recall, Alan had been fired from the Super Save in 1964 for stealing money from them, and throughout his lifetime, it turned out he was fired from no less than 6 jobs, one of where he was the director of a charity organization for theft. At the time of his arrest, Alan was executive director of the Great Falls Community Food Bank, but evidence was uncovered to show that he had taken dozens of donation checks to a credit union where he had a personal account, even though the food bank had a business account at another bank. Alan would then convert the checks into money orders after telling the credit union employees he would be using them to pay the bills for the food bank, but in actuality, he spent the money on such things as remodeling his house and paying off his credit card debt. In total, it was estimated that he had embezzled over $100,000. In March of 2003, after agreeing to a plea deal, Alan pled guilty to 5 counts of felony theft. He received a 25-year prison sentence and was also ordered to pay $121,000 in restitution. However, Alan continued to maintain his innocence on the murder charges, and since Alan's defense attorney feared that his theft convictions might unfairly prejudice a jury, he decided to ask for a bench trial. This meant that District Judge Thomas McKittrick would be responsible for delivering the verdict, and the Cascade County Attorney's Office decided to reduce the charges from first-degree murder to second-degree murder. However, the trial would be delayed for a year after Alan's defense team filed a motion to suppress the supposedly incriminating statements he had made at the religious retreat. They argued that since a priest had been present when Alan made those statements, they should have been protected by religious confidentiality statutes. Judge McKittrick denied this motion, but he did rule some other pieces of evidence to be inadmissible, including the secretly recorded conversation between Alan and Mary Klesch, as McKittrick believed it had been obtained improperly. The judge also disallowed some of Alan's statements from his police interview because detectives did not read him his Miranda rights until after these statements took place. The Cascade County Attorney's Office appealed this to the Montana Supreme Court, and they overruled Judge McKittrick's decision, so Alan's statements and the recorded conversation would be allowed into evidence when the trial finally began in February of 2004. Most of the Arada children would attend the trial, though tragically, the oldest son, John, had been killed in a car accident in 1982 at the age of 27. When she took the witness stand, Terry recounted her story about seeing the shadowy outline of a man closing her bedroom door on the night of the murders, but even though she still maintained that she did not see the man's face, she now added a surprising detail. According to Terry, the police had sent her a younger photograph of Alan from his time on the high school football team, and after looking at his build and blonde hair, she was now convinced that Alan was the same man she saw in her bedroom. This statement took both the defense and the prosecution by complete surprise, so much so that the defense attempted to ask for a mistrial, though this request was denied. The prosecution faced a major uphill battle, especially after the defense called upon 2 forensic scientists from the crime lab, who testified that there was no physical evidence linking Alan to the murders. Since no one was thinking about DNA back in 1964, a lot of the items from the crime scene were collected by officers who weren't wearing gloves, and some of the most important pieces of evidence, such as the knife, the bloody gloves, and the Arada's clothing, were stored on top of each other, causing them to be contaminated. Other key pieces of evidence, such as Alan's clothes, the bloody aprons, and Jim's bloodstained wallet, were no longer available. The 2 least contaminated pieces of evidence did contain a mixture of DNA, but it did not match Alan, and while Alan had type O blood, no blood matching that type was found at the store. Three hairs had been found inside the bloody elkskin gloves the killer wore, but they did not match Alan either. Even though Alan's father had passed away by this point, his mother and sister both took the stand to back up his alibi and confirm that they never saw any bloody clothing or suspicious behavior from Alan after the murders. The deputy county attorney who originally handled the case was also called upon to testify and stated that Alan had passed a polygraph and was cleared as a suspect 6 weeks after the murders took place because of the lack of evidence. In the end, Judge McKittrick did not believe that the prosecution's case had proved Alan's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Only 24 hours after both sides presented their closing arguments, McKittrick returned with a verdict in which he found Alan not guilty of both murders. He stated, quote, "There is no physical evidence linking Alan Reevely to the murders. The science of 1964 does not support the state's theory of the case. The science of 2004, including DNA testing, does not support the state's theory of the case, but instead weighs heavily in favor of the defendant," end quote. Of course, since Alan had previously pled guilty to the unrelated theft charges, he would not become a free man, and he wound up spending 10 years at the Montana State Prison in Deer Lodge before he was paroled in June of 2013. In spite of the acquittal, the Great Falls Police Department announced that they still believed Alan was the guilty party and would not be conducting any further investigation into the murders. So the truth about who was actually responsible for the deaths of Jim and Lois Arada remains up for debate. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, I would like to take a few moments to talk about our sponsor, Best Fiends. We all have forms of entertainment which we consider to be guilty pleasures, whether it be a campy TV show, a cheesy movie, a song that's secretly your jam. Hell, some people would consider the true crime genre to be a guilty pleasure. But you know what form of entertainment I feel zero guilt about? Best Fiends, which provides an endless source of fun which I can access anytime on my phone. It's a match 3 puzzle game unlike any other, with thousands of levels and new content being added all the time. So I guess you could say, I'm a little obsessed. Okay, scratch that. A lot obsessed. Researching and recording a true crime podcast can sometimes be grueling work, so Best Fiends functions as a good outlet to help me unwind. I never thought I would play a handheld puzzle game for this long, but it's been about a year and a half since I originally started Best Fiends, and I recently passed level 1200. Does this sound fun to you? Well, you can download Best Fiends free today from the Apple App Store and Google Play and get started. I'd love to know what you think, but just don't blame me if you've become slightly obsessed. This game is what I'd like to describe as boredom's worst nightmare. So download Best Fiends free today from the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So this is definitely not the first case I've covered on The Trail Went Cold in which someone was charged with a crime and went on trial, but wound up being acquitted. In some of these cases, it was clear that they charged the wrong person, but in others, you got the sense that a guilty person wound up getting away with it. However, this one is particularly unique since the trial took place nearly 40 years after the crime originally occurred, and barring any rock-solid evidence such as DNA, it's really hard to get a conviction under those circumstances. As far as the authorities in Cascade County are concerned, this case is officially closed, as they still believe that Alan Reevely committed these murders, and there's nothing else they can do because of double jeopardy. And even if someone else was the guilty party, chances are they might be dead after all these years. Of course, as we've seen during the past few years, a lot of older cold cases have been solved through DNA and genetic genealogy, and this even allows investigators to conclusively link evidence to suspects who are currently deceased. However, in this particular case, most of the physical evidence was contaminated so badly that not even genetic genealogy is a surefire option. It's quite fascinating to go back and look at the original coverage in the local newspaper, the Great Falls Tribune, after Alan Reevely was arrested. At first, a lot of residents were coming out of the woodwork to voice their support for Alan, describing him as this kind, gentle man who was an absolute pillar of the community and could not possibly have been capable of committing a brutal double murder. But public sentiment against Alan drastically changed a few weeks later, once it was discovered that he was embezzling money from the local food bank and was a compulsive thief who had been fired from nearly every single job he ever worked for stealing. Given the circumstances, I definitely believe that Alan's defense team made a wise choice by selecting a bench trial instead of a jury trial, as they believed the publicity surrounding Alan's felony theft convictions could have unfairly influenced the jury's verdict. It is a big risk to ask for a bench trial and allow a judge to render the verdict, because if you're found guilty, that makes it a lot more difficult to overturn the conviction. But if the prosecution's case is a genuinely weak one, you can usually be assured that a judge will be objective and let the evidence decide the verdict, not their personal feelings. As another example, I released an episode a few years ago about the 2001 disappearance of Michelle Harris, whose husband, Cal Harris, was convicted of her murder, even though her body was never found and there was very little evidence that an actual crime had even taken place. It was not until Cal's fourth trial that his defense team asked for a bench trial, as they apparently felt that the previous juries had convicted Cal because he came across as a very unlikable person. And the strategy paid off, because the trial judge did not believe the evidence proved Cal's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and found him not guilty. I do have to commend District Judge Thomas McKittrick for rendering an objective not guilty verdict for Alan Reevely, even though it was fairly obvious he disliked Alan on a personal level. McKittrick was on the bench when Alan pled guilty to the felony theft charges and read him the riot act when he sentenced him to 25 years in prison, believing that he deserved a severe punishment for doing something as immoral as embezzling money from a food bank. But when Alan went on trial for murder, McKittrick put his personal feelings aside and acquitted him, and I definitely believe he made the right call. That doesn't necessarily mean that Alan is innocent, but the case against him was incredibly weak, and there was definitely a lot of reasonable doubt. There was no physical evidence linking Alan to the crime, and all the prosecution really had on him were some supposedly incriminating statements he made, which could easily be misinterpreted. Obviously, Alan's compulsive history of stealing showed that he had some serious issues, but that does not prove he was a murderer. Now, I will acknowledge that despite the lack of hard evidence, Alan being the killer of Jim and Lois Arada would seem like the most logical theory on the surface. Jim had fired Alan from his job at the store for theft only a few weeks before the crime took place, and the time lock was installed on the safe a short time later, meaning that Alan would not have known this if he attempted a robbery. It's been theorized that the reason Jim and Lois had Pepsi bottles smashed across their heads and were stabbed so many times was because the killer went into a violent rage once they realized the safe could not be opened under any circumstances. It seems very likely that the perpetrator knew the layout of the super safe and may have been a current or former employee. The items used in the commission of this crime, such as the clothesline, the apron strings, and the knife, all originated from inside the store and would not have been that easy for an outsider to find. All that being said, any theory which involves Alan committing these murders is going to have some sizable holes which the prosecution were unable to plug at his trial. The biggest unanswered question in this case, which has never been satisfactorily explained, is how the Aradas wound up at the Super Save, since it would have required them to leave their children home alone in the middle of the night. We definitely know that the killer entered the residence at some point, but did they wake up Jim and Lois and force them to drive to the store against their will? Or did the killer go to the house after the murders took place? Well, the theory that investigators have always believed is that Jim and Lois were lured to the store and drove there themselves in their own station wagon, and after they were killed, the perpetrator subsequently drove the car back to their neighborhood and parked it in a nearby alley. They then entered the Arada residence and stole the coin collection and disposed of the bloody elkskin gloves in a dumpster across the street. I have to admit that when I first started reading the details of this case, I initially suspected that an intruder broke into the residence first and stole the coin collection before they forced Jim and Lois to drive them to the grocery store so they could rob the safe. However, I think it would have been difficult to pull off an abduction like that in a house containing 7 sleeping children without any of them hearing anything. One piece of evidence which seems to point to the Arradas driving to the store of their own volition is that Lois was found with a handkerchief around her neck, as I'm not sure the perpetrator would have allowed her to take the time to do that if they were being forced to leave against their will. Since Jim's store, house, and car keys were found on the kitchen counter the following morning, the killer likely took them from him and may have used the keys to enter the residence, which would explain why there were no signs of forced entry. But of course, this still doesn't explain how the Arradas were lured to the store to begin with. It doesn't sound like any of the children reported hearing the sound of the phone ringing in the middle of the night, and being that this was 1964, I'm not sure if phone records were checked to see if any calls were made to the residence. I could definitely see someone phoning up Jim and telling him there was a problem at the store, such as a robbery or something, but what I don't understand is why Jim would have brought Lois with him. Since the oldest daughter, Terry, was 12, it sounds like she was entrusted to watch over the other children when their parents were gone, but even if they didn't want to wake Terry up, it's surprising that they wouldn't have at least left a note in case one of the children woke up. While it seems risky for the killer to have driven back to the residence, you can understand why they would do this, as their total take from both the store and Jim's wallet was only $37. They probably wanted the coin collection in order to make some sort of profit, but how would they have known about it to begin with? Investigators theorized that when Jim was unable to open the safe, he may have told the killer about his coin collection and where he kept it, in hopes that it would compel them to spare his life, though this obviously didn't work. I'd be willing to bet that the killer may not have been expecting Lois to show up at the store, and was completely thrown off by her presence, and learning that the safe could not be opened, then threw him completely over the edge. It has been theorized that multiple people could have been involved in this crime, but I think the fact that Lois's feet were tied to the rear door suggests a lone perpetrator, as they may have wanted to keep her subdued while they took Jim to the safe. Those who believe that Alan Reevely was the guilty party have alleged that the brutality of this crime was also brought on by the high level of stress in his personal life at that time. He was fired from the store only a few weeks earlier, he had recently learned that his girlfriend, Mary Klesch, was pregnant, and he had such a heated disagreement with his parents over his relationship with Mary that they sent him to a psychiatric ward for a few days. It's not implausible that Alan may have felt compelled to orchestrate a robbery from the Super Save so that he would have had enough money to skip town with Mary. It's interesting how it turned out that Mary was not actually pregnant at all, though it's unclear if this was just an honest mistake or if she intentionally lied to him. One of the main pieces of evidence against Alan was a secretly recorded conversation that took place between him and Mary 37 years later, but it turned out that Mary was not exactly a saint herself. You see, in May of 2004, 3 months after the conclusion of Alan's trial, Mary Klesch wound up going to court in Idaho to plead guilty to 2 counts of felony grand theft because she had stolen 2 heirloom diamond rings from a blind woman and $3,000 in cash from another elderly woman who were both residents at a retirement community Mary managed. 1 year earlier, Mary had been fired from this job for running the retirement community without a license and facing numerous allegations of robbing her clients. As a result, she wound up receiving a 4-year prison sentence. If that wasn't enough, in 1987, Mary was accused of taking out a $500,000 life insurance policy on a firefighter named Jerry Herney, who would be killed in a plane crash shortly thereafter, and Mary's husband at the time was believed to have sold him the policy. Now, this sounds like a pretty intriguing side story in its own right, but unfortunately, I couldn't find any additional information available about it. Mary's other legal problems likely have nothing to do with the Arada murders, but even though she broke up with Alan, I find it fascinating that these two high school sweethearts seem to be compulsive thieves and wound up going to prison for theft in two different states 4 decades later. But if Alan was guilty of the murders, it's crazy to think of the possibility of Mary paving the way for them by lying to Alan about her pregnancy. However, we can speculate all we want, and that still doesn't change the fact that there was just no direct evidence placing Alan inside the Super Save that night. As a former employee, I'm sure he would not have been able to access the store after it was closed, though I suppose Alan could have called the Arada residence from a payphone and then attacked Jim and Lois after they arrived and unlocked the door. But one question which was never adequately addressed at Alan's trial is how he was able to lure Jim to the store to begin with. They weren't exactly on the best of terms, since Jim had recently fired Alan, so what could Alan have said to compel Jim to leave his house in the middle of the night? Alan's family also provided him with an alibi, though given that they would have been asleep, there's no way they could say with 100% certainty that he did not leave the house that night. You would definitely think that a crime which involved stabbing two people a total of 22 times would have left a lot of blood on the killer, but we know that Alan's mother washed his clothing and turned it over to the police later that same morning. So unless she was intentionally lying or concealing evidence for him, it does not sound like she noticed anything out of the ordinary from Alan. Overall, the only real evidence against Alan at his trial were the supposedly incriminating statements he made at a religious retreat, during his police interview, and on the recorded conversation between him and Mary, as well as Terry Arada expressing her personal belief that the man she saw in her bedroom doorway was Alan. Given that Judge McKittrick attempted to make two of those pieces of evidence inadmissible before the state Supreme Court overruled him, then it really shouldn't have been any surprise that he came back with a not guilty verdict. It's admittedly pretty odd that Alan supposedly told people that he was the one who personally discovered the Arada's bodies, but given his lifetime propensity for theft and fraud, it would certainly be in character for him to make up stories and lie like that. It's also pretty convenient that the case was reopened when the brother of one of the lead investigators shared this information, even though he had originally heard Alan make those statements nearly 7 years earlier. The problem is that all of these seemingly incriminating things Alan said could be interpreted in so many different ways, and it's not like he ever went so far as to reveal details about the crime that only the killer could have known. If you want to use these statements to convict Alan of murder, you need other corroborating evidence. The issue with Terry's testimony about the man in her bedroom is that for all we know, it could have been nothing more than a vivid dream. Now, I do believe that she really saw the killer, because if he traveled to the residence to steal the coin collection from Jim's bedroom, then it makes sense that he would stop to close the door of one of the children's rooms if he was passing through the hallway. But it's problematic that even though Terry never saw this man's face, she said in open court that she believed it was Alan, based on his build and his hair, and it sounds like she completely made this statement out of nowhere without telling anyone beforehand. To recap, Terry came to this conclusion because she had seen an old high school photograph of Alan from 1964, but she was comparing it to a nearly 40-year-old memory of an event she experienced when she was half asleep. Alan's defense attorney also pointed out that Terry's recollection of the man's build was meaningless since Alan was wearing football pads in the photo, though Terry said she did take that into account. I certainly do not believe Terry was intentionally lying, as she probably convinced herself she saw Alan in her bedroom, but I think she was being influenced by confirmation bias because Alan was already on trial for the murders. Before I move on from Alan, I should also mention that John Cameron, one of the cold case detectives from the Great Falls Police Department who charged Alan with murder, has gone on to become a bit of a controversial figure in the true crime world. Following his retirement, Cameron published a book about Edward Wayne Edwards, a serial killer who did not get charged with his first murders until he was 76 years old, before he died in 2011. While Cameron has attempted to link Edwards to pretty much every famous unsolved murder of the past several decades, such as the Black Dahlia, the Zodiac Murders, Jimmy Hoffa, Adam Walsh, the West Memphis Three, JonBenet Ramsey, Lacey Peterson, Teresa Halbach, and I think it goes without saying that not everyone agrees with that assessment. While I'm not saying that has any relevance to this particular case, it does make it easier to believe that Cameron could have been wrong about Alan Reevely. Okay, so if Alan was not responsible for this crime, then who was? Well, I'm definitely inclined to believe that the killer had to be familiar with the layout of the store, so it makes sense that the two other people who were looked at as potential suspects were employees. One of them was Clarence Anderson, the produce manager who showed up and discovered Jim's body after the store opened. The main reasons Anderson was suspected was because he was known for having a violent temper, he supposedly did not get along with Jim, and he apparently had cuts on his hands that morning. And of course, Jim and Lois were found near the produce section, and that's where the murder weapon originated from. Unfortunately, other than what I just shared, there really isn't much information available or any other evidence that might link him to the crime, and it's unclear if Anderson's position as produce manager would have given him enough authority to have his own key to access the store. I went over how Alan likely wouldn't have known there was a time lock on the safe, but how many of the other current employees besides Jim would have known this? Because if Anderson was privy to this information, then it would have been completely pointless for him to attempt a robbery when the safe literally could not be opened in the middle of the night. And the biggest wild card in this whole case is the presence of the night janitor, George Suhada, whom, appropriately enough, was also looked at as a potential suspect. I have to assume that anyone who worked or used to work at that store would have known that Suhada would be there after closing. However, it sounds like Suhada went outside to clean the parking lot at some point during his shift, and if he happened to leave the door unlocked, the killer could have used this opportunity to sneak inside. This intruder might have also caused the strange noises Suhada claimed he heard, which frightened him and compelled him to leave the store early. But the problem is that we don't have a good handle on the exact timeline of when these events took place. I am confused by the wording and the sources, which state that Suhada came under suspicion because he did not have a verifiable alibi after 12:50 a.m. So does this mean that Suhada said he left the store at 12:50? We have the eyewitness account from the Arada's neighbor, who said they saw the couple's station wagon running outside their house at around midnight, and Terry said she woke up and saw a man in her bedroom doorway at 1 a.m. It's not clear to me how Terry knew the exact time this event happened, unless she happened to catch a glimpse of a clock or something, but if both these times are accurate, then this means that Jim and Lois were murdered inside the store sometime after midnight before the killer traveled to the residence. Since it sounds like Suhada placed himself inside the store at 12:50, this could imply any number of things. Those noises he heard could have been the murders taking place without him even realizing it, he could have misremembered the exact time he left, or he was just flat out lying. On the surface, Suhada being the killer would make a lot of sense because he was given the key to the super safe and would have been there alone after closing. He also likely had knowledge of the store's layout, and as the night janitor, he may not have been privy to the fact that the safe had a time lock. If he decided to call Jim and lure him to the store by telling him that there was some sort of problem, then Jim wouldn't have had any reason to disbelieve him. But in spite of potential issues with his alibi, it does not sound like there was any direct evidence that Suhada committed these murders. It's also worth mentioning that Suhada appeared to be shorter than the man Terry saw in her bedroom, and he had black hair instead of blonde, which might be the main reason he was not pursued more vigorously as a suspect. Once again, the issue with linking Suhada, Anderson, or any other potential suspects to this crime is that the forensic evidence was mishandled and improperly stored, so it doesn't sound like there's much in the way of viable DNA which could conclusively identify the perpetrator. For all we know, there may have been physical evidence which implicated Alan Reevely, but it was destroyed or no longer exists. Unfortunately, barring a confession, I'm not sure it would be possible to solve this crime after all these years, and the investigation was officially closed after Alan was acquitted. I don't completely discount the possibility that Alan was the killer, but there just wasn't the evidence to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, and there are too many missing pieces of the puzzle to figure out with any certainty what might have happened. But if you happen to have any information about the murders of Jim and Lois Arada, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode which covered two cases from Unsolved Mysteries involving young women who were supposedly afflicted with amnesia after surviving a violent attack. The stories of Kyra Cook and Sarah Powell. And for our patrons in tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Anya, Liz B, Nora, Jordan D, Mariah A, Sarah M, Lucy L, Gabia V, and Morwen. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, The Prosecutors.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And together, we host a true crime podcast called The Prosecutors.
Every week, we bring our perspective as prosecutors to some of the toughest cold cases of all time.
Disappearances, murder, mayhem, you name it, we'll cover it.
So join us for a true crime podcast with a different point of view.
Because we are The Prosecutors.
I'd also like to mention that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London. I had previously stated that CrimeCon UK was set to take place on the weekend of June the 12th and 13th, but due to restrictions, they have now elected to postpone it until the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. So fingers crossed that it will still happen as planned. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLE21. That's COLE21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.